Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the challenges facing dairy producers here in Wisconsin and a possible solution that some farm groups are making the case for. First, it's the week in Washington, where we check in on several top stories in national politics. President-elect Joe Biden's campaign now has the formal go-ahead from the Trump administration to begin formally transitioning into power, while President Trump continues his push to overturn the results of the election after a long string of losses in the courts. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. We're going to look at the cabinet announcements so far from President-elect Biden. Have you been following those nominations? What do you think of some of the names he's picked? Who would you like to see represented in the cabinet? And what kind of policies would you like to see those cabinet appointees advocating for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Duren covers Congress and American politics at the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Washington. Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, President Trump still hasn't formally conceded. He's still talking about contesting the outcome of the election. But we have this General Services Administration announcement saying, yeah, Biden team, you can get access to information, to funding, to offices, things like that. How big a deal is that?
I think it's a step that certainly the Biden transition team and Democrats in Washington had been anxious to see happen. I mean, yeah, this is important for a number of reasons. I mean, it does allow the transition team to now begin holding more formal conversations with folks at executive agencies across the government about, how things are going there, what's going on, and how the Biden administration can eventually step in and kind of, hit the ground running, so to speak. I think it's also important, in terms of there's a cybersecurity angle to all of this. So without GSA ascertaining the results of the election, the Biden transition team had been, using their own email security services, for example. And so things like that do, carry a certain amount of risk in terms of just national security. And then there's of course, the president-elect receiving regular intelligence briefings. And so that is also something that a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill in particular had focused on as something that needed to start happening so that, when Joe Biden does take over next year, that he is, again, just up to speed on all the various national security and intelligence developments before he takes office.
We'll get into what we know about cabinet appointments, potential ones, in just a couple of minutes. But what else have we been seeing from the Biden team when it comes to trying to get this transition in order, both leading up to this GSA determination and since?
So, yeah, he's named, not only has he named folks who he intends to nominate to a bunch of cabinet positions or will nominate to cabinet positions, but also several of his top staffers within the White House, people who are positions that do not require Senate confirmation. So we've seen a pretty steady, set of those folks being announced. And then he's held briefings and meetings with top Democrats on Capitol Hill. So one of the primary things on the agenda for Democrats and Republicans in Washington right now is trying to pass another coronavirus relief bill. And so these negotiations have been going on for months and months. But now, President-elect Biden is more formally involved in those. He held a meeting in person with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer last week. And they discussed, how they can get a bill like that together during the lame duck and before Biden actually takes over. So I'm sure things are plenty busy for the transition folks.
Talking to Andy Duren from The Wall Street Journal. It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching cabinet announcements from the Biden team? And what are you looking for in a new cabinet? 800-642-1234. Andy, some key appointments. I mean, the top spot in the cabinet in many ways is the Secretary of State. We've got a Treasury Secretary nominee. Talk about what we're seeing so far from the Biden team.
Yeah, so I think overall you're seeing, so at Secretary of State, you have Antony Blinken, and then in Treasury, the Wall Street Journal and a bunch of other outlets have reported that Janet Yellen is the choice for that cabinet, though it has not been formally announced. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in both those cases, in the case of Blinken, I mean, he's someone who's worked for Joe Biden for a long time now, has been kind of a part of Biden's team during the campaign advising him, and is seen as someone who will, you know, both be a kind of credible representative of you know, the Joe Biden when he's the president in terms of speaking on his behalf, and then also is seen as someone to have a more kind of conventional view of, you know, America's role in the world in terms of trying to work through, you know, international alliances, multilateral organizations, and trying to kind of project American power that way, rather than, you know, what we've seen the last few years, which has focused more on the United States acting independently. And then in the case of Janet Yellen, I mean, she's someone who has served, you know, in the White House during the Clinton administration. She was the Fed chair during the Obama administration, and now she'll be the Treasury Secretary during the Biden administration. So she's obviously been around kind of democratic economic policymaking for a long time now. And I think she, I believe she will be the first person to have held a role both as the, you know, the lead of the Council of Economic Advisors, the Fed chair, and now the Treasury Secretary. And so she is someone who I think, you know, obviously is kind of an old hand at this and is very experienced, but she's also someone who's, you know, well-respected and well-liked by, you know, kind of across the Democratic Party. You know, she's someone who obviously Biden chose, but then kind of more progressive Democrats, liberal Democrats have also kind of endorsed her selection. Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, you know, was quick to say that she supported Yellen's nomination. And so, yeah, I think basically you're seeing so far, you know, experienced people in the, you know, who've worked in Democratic politics, worked for Joe Biden possibly for a long time, and who have possibly conventional approaches or, you know, established approaches to policymaking at the executive level.
You mentioned Antony Blinken announced as the nominee upcoming for Secretary of State. Here's a listen to him talking about, in this case, the story of his stepfather as a child surviving the Holocaust in Poland. Here's a listen.
At the end of the war, he made a break from a death march into the woods in Bavaria. From his hiding place, he heard a deep rumbling sound. It was a tank. But instead of the Iron Cross, he saw painted on its side a five-pointed white star. He ran to the tank. The hatch opened. An African-American GI looked down at him. He got down on his knees and said the only three words that he knew in English that his mother had taught him before the war. God bless America. That's who we are. That's what America represents to the world, however imperfectly. Now, we have to proceed with equal measures of humility and confidence.
So a powerful personal story there from Antony Blinken, Secretary of State nominee, coming up, not officially nominated yet. But it fits a theme, I think, Andy, of what the Biden team, a message they were sending about how they're approaching foreign policy differently than the Trump administration. Can you talk about what we've seen there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this is the idea is to, I think, reengage with, you know, countries that have, you know, long been close American allies and work with them through through the infrastructure that was set up after World War II, the international kind of policymaking infrastructure that was set up after World War II. You know, under the Trump administration, you saw things like, you know, the United States kind of challenging NATO countries to, you know, contribute more to their own military defense. You saw things like the United States moving troops out of Germany. You saw, you know, just in general, the Trump administration was trying to basically encourage or prod allies to, you know, pick up some of the weight themselves and contribute to their own defense or play a role that the United States had traditionally played for them. I think under the Biden administration, we'll probably see a less confrontational approach between the United States and its, you know, European and its allies in Europe, its allies in Asia, and I think elsewhere. I mean, I think we'll see again, just a more conventional approach to our, you know, the American footprint and our relationship with our allies overseas.
We invited our listeners to call in with their ideas, what they want to see from a Biden cabinet in terms of people or policies. Let's go to our callers now. Paul is with us in La Crosse. Paul, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Paul?
There's a 1985 Sherman Antitrust Act. It's basically an anti-monopoly law. I think Biden should start looking at more, maybe tweaking the law or maybe add to it or take away from it, and in terms of economic distress in this country, and make it, you know, better.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And I know some progressives in the Democratic Party, Andy, want to see in some cases more confrontational approaches between the government and large businesses, including maybe in some cases antitrust. Have we seen any signals along those lines yet?
I mean, I think that's certainly something we could see under a Biden administration. I mean, that actually, and I think this is one of those areas where there's kind of a broad bipartisan agreement that there should be more. There should be maybe some action taken against large companies. I mean, I think in particular, there's been a lot of bipartisan ire focused on big tech companies, companies like Facebook and Google. There seems to be a bipartisan motivation to take on those companies. I mean, you saw the Justice Department under President Trump take some antitrust actions and sue Google, for example, in court. And so I think it will be interesting to see, you know, how much of that continues, or, you know, even if maybe there are some of these same concerns about the power and the influence and the concentration of large corporations, you know, if there's a change in tactics or a change in approach, while also maybe sharing kind of the same, you know, general viewpoint on the concentration of corporate power.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Chad now in Madison. Chad, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just thinking Andrew Yang would be the perfect choice because Democrats can't lose any more House representatives or senators to put into the cabinet. So he would be a perfect choice because progressives would be, you know, a little bit happier with knowing that we have somebody on our side that's in there. So,
Chad, thanks a lot for the call. Andy, Biden turned to one of his former Democratic primary opponents as his running mate. Any thought of or any talk about Andrew Yang or any of the other large field of Democratic candidates making it to a cabinet position?
Yeah, so I haven't heard anything about Andrew Yang specifically, but I think so far, you know, Biden has signaled that he might not. That while some of his choices so far have not, you know, necessarily upset progressives, he also hasn't chosen someone who's considered kind of a progressive superstar. I mean, I think the most, you know, telling thing he said recently on that question is he said in an NBC interview yesterday that he's unlikely to maybe pull someone out of the House or the Senate to fill a cabinet post. So the kind of most, you know, the people who that have the clearest consequences for are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, two of his rivals in the presidential primary, who are, you know, kind of progressive superstars and leaders of that wing of the party. And they're both folks who, you know, had been considered or rumored or seen as possible selections for Treasury in the sake of Elizabeth Warren, and then the Labor Department in Bernie Sanders' instance. And so, I think that it's possible that, you know, we could still see, you know, there are a lot of cabinet positions. And so we could still see, you know, people who have kind of well-established kind of progressive followings and progressive bona fides enter the cabinet in some capacity. But, you know, he has started to signal at least that it's unlikely to be Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren.
Thanks, Chad, for the call. We're talking to Andy Duren from The Wall Street Journal. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics coming up. More COVID-19 funding, the return of Infrastructure Week. Do you want to see the House and Senate agree on COVID-19 relief funding before the year ends? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Andy Duren, congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want Congress to pass new COVID-19 economic relief funding? If so, what should the focus be? Should it be big or small? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andy, this has been going on for months now. The House had passed a plan. The Senate has looked at different plans. Nothing is happening. What is the state of the art when it comes to more COVID-19 economic relief?
So, there have been talks on and off again for several months now between Republicans and Democrats on another one of these relief bills. I mean, the biggest issue has just been a kind of totally different set of scales in terms of what each party thinks is necessary. Democrats see, you know, more than $2 trillion as being in the neighborhood of what the country needs right now in terms of more relief, and Republicans see about $500 billion. So that's, you know, that's a big difference. And that's kind of remained the widest chasm between the two parties. But we are coming up towards the end of the year now, and a couple of things are happening that might kind of pull people to get to work something out, or at least agree to something. So one is that the virus continues to get worse in a lot of places in a lot of the country. There are, you know, some expectations that will, you know, start to have an impact on the economy, and that the economic recovery that started over the summer will kind of slow and even stop, and that we might start to see unemployment climb again and enter kind of a double dip recession. So there's that to contend with. Then at the same time, several aid programs that were approved in the spring are expiring at the end of the calendar year. So those are certain types of unemployment benefits, you know, things like deferments on federally held student loans, an eviction moratorium ordered by the CDC. Those are all coming to the end this year, are all coming to an end at the end of this year. And then the third thing is that the government is just regular government funding is set to run out in December. And so Congress is already working towards figuring out an agreement on just funding the government. And so with all of that happening, Congress might try to extend some of these existing programs, or even, agree to additional aid measures that would be passed in conjunction with a spending agreement to keep the government funded after December 11th.
Let's bring on a caller on this topic. Miles is on the line in Grafton. Miles, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, I would love if they were able to pass, you know, more relief or another stimulus, especially before the new year. You know, people talk about living paycheck to paycheck. I'm out here living rent to rent, and my wife hasn't even bought groceries for the last few weeks. I mean, we're making it work, but it's hard out here for some of us lower-income families, you know?
Was your job hit by COVID-19 or your wife's, Miles?
My job was at the time I'm transitioning right now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wanted to hear the answer to that. Your line's breaking up, Miles. Thank you for calling in. Good luck to you and your family. And some people, their jobs, of course, in the restaurant industry, entertainment, travel, Andy, hit super hard. Is there talk of something really focused on those people who have really taken the brunt of COVID-19 and the damage it's done to their part of the economy?
Yeah, so there is talk. There's talk on a number of different things that would target those folks. So one is reviving more generous unemployment checks that were in place for kind of the first part of the pandemic between March and July, where the federal government was adding $600 a week to the state unemployment benefits that states typically pay out. So both Republicans and Democrats want to put more federal money on top of that. There's a disagreement in terms of how much, but that is one way that, you know, folks who did lose their job or who will lose their job as a result of the pandemic could rely on a more generous unemployment benefit. Another is, you know, there are discussions of, some Democrats certainly favor doing sending another $1,200 stimulus check to many Americans. So that is something that could help a lot of folks. And then there's also, loaning more money to and sending more money to small businesses across the country to try and prevent layoffs in the first place. So there was a big small business loan program, the Paycheck Protection Program, it is called that, basically $500 billion to businesses across the country. And that loan was forgivable if, businesses use that money to keep people on payroll and continue to pay them, even if, you know, they were shut down or if they weren't operating. So those are some of the three kind of biggest tools Congress has and that they used, you know, earlier this year. They just, because of the impasse, a lot of those programs expired or, you know, aren't available to folks anymore or could expire soon. And so Congress is likely, if they were to do something, to revive or renew some of those efforts.
And Andy, I want to take a couple of minutes to look at a piece you wrote on what's kind of become an evergreen topic, the idea that infrastructure is something that Republicans and Democrats can work together on, a place where they can find some compromise. What's the latest on that with the incoming Biden administration?
Yeah, so obviously it became kind of a running joke, a bad joke in the Trump administration, this idea that there would be a week dedicated to infrastructure and both parties would come together and pass a big infrastructure bill. And obviously that didn't happen over the course of 4 years. When Trump came into office, Democrats were optimistic that this was something they could work with the new president on, but it never materialized. Now with the, with the prospect that, there will again be divided government next year if Republicans hold on to control of the Senate, which, certainly seems like it's possible. There are two runoff races in Georgia on January 5th that will determine which party has a majority in that chamber. And so, in the event that there is again divided government, Republicans do control the Senate, the one policy area that people I talked to said, the two parties could come together on beyond kind of just the things they have to get done to prevent calamity is infrastructure. So, there's been a longstanding need for infrastructure. A lot of civil engineers and experts say that, America's infrastructure system, whether that's roads or water systems or the energy grid or, the various forms of infrastructure is kind of in drastic need of renewed federal investment. And so this is already something that Democrats are preparing for as something that they will try and focus on next year, kind of no matter how the Senate goes. And they also see it as a form of economic stimulus. There's obviously these discussions now about a relief bill, but even kind of later on in 2021, there might be an effort to do a more long lasting and a more kind of conventional stimulus bill to inject money into the economy. And that, infrastructure is one of those, certainly one of those options. And so we'll see how it goes. Obviously, there's been a bipartisan desire for this for a long time. Republicans didn't do it when they had total control of the government the first 2 years of the Trump administration. It didn't happen under divided government of the Trump administration. But, some folks are at least optimistic that, with a new White House and, maybe a more concentrated push from the White House to try and get something done, that we could possibly see an infrastructure bill sometime in 2021.
Andy, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Andy Duren covers Congress and U.S. politics for The Wall Street Journal. We talked to him today about some of the week's top stories in national politics, including President-elect Biden's announcements of some picks for cabinet positions and the state of federal coronavirus relief. Coming up after the news, we take a look at how supply management could help Wisconsin's dairy industry. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, if you enjoy a morning cup of coffee or if you count on it, like I do, it could be at risk with a plant disease that's threatening coffee crops. Find out what's going on and the science behind the efforts to save our beans. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, last year alone, Wisconsin lost 10% of the state's dairy farms, leaving just over 7,200 in the state. Years of low milk prices have given many small dairies few options beyond selling their herds. The Wisconsin Farmers Union says we could stop the damage and decrease dependence on federal subsidies by implementing supply management. And the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation approved a statement at the end of 2018 saying, quote, "We are willing to consider a flexible supply management system." We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you or did you used to be a dairy farmer? How have you seen things change over the years for better or worse? What changes would you like to see that you think might help the state's dairy economy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Darren Von Ruden is a dairy farmer from Westby and president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And Joe Breiger runs a farm in Buffalo County and is the president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ron. Very happy to be here today. Thank you.
Before we get to the idea of supply management, I want to get each of your takes on the state of dairy in Wisconsin and the challenges facing dairy farmers. Joe, let's start with you. What are you seeing out there?
Well, let's start a little bit quick for some of the things that we can celebrate. When we look at Wisconsin, and you look at the farms out on the landscape, Wisconsin is home to 1,200 licensed cheesemakers. In the state of Wisconsin, we make over 600 types and varieties of cheeses. And one of every 4 pounds of cheese consumed in the United States comes out of Wisconsin. Those are certainly some amazing feats. When we look at dairy from a national perspective, I believe 2018, we had a 56-year high in domestic consumption and record exports. This year, we are approaching a 60-year high in domestic consumption. And just looking at the reports that came through the other day, we are at, we're going to surpass 2018 in exports. So we have a lot to celebrate, but we also have to have a lot to consider. You know, on the start of the program, it was mentioned the number of farms. In 2003, we had 16,000 dairy farms here in Wisconsin. That number has dropped to below 7,000 where we stand right now. So certainly our farmers have had 5 very tough years, followed by COVID, which has really hit. And when we look at really talking about farmers having a seat at the table, think of how disheartening it would be for how much effort our farmers put into producing healthy and nutritious dairy products to not be able to sell them, to have to dispose of dairy, milk, while consumer shelves were empty earlier this year. So we do have some inelasticity in our dairy system that we need to look at. And definitely our farmers have been struggling for a protracted period of time, and we have much concern.
And Darren, I know part of the concern you have at the Farmers Union in particular is concerns over overproduction of milk as you see it. How is that contributing to the challenges facing especially small to mid-sized farms?
Well, it adds to the economic hardship that's out there. When you have an oversupply of any product, the prices usually drop to below what production costs are. And so as farmers are trying to stay alive, they're continually strained in that process of trying to raise their income. And so having some form of supply management that can keep supply and demand in balance would stabilize those prices. It's nice as an organic farmer, we have a stable price from year to year. It might go up a dollar or down a dollar year to year, just depending on consumer demand, but at least we can budget for what our next year looks like. And in the conventional side, you know, we just don't see that. When you have swings of $10 to $12 in a 6-month period, it's really hard to budget for the next year and even look ahead.
Can you introduce us to this idea, Darren, of supply management for dairy? What would that look like in practice?
So, you know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of knowledge of what the Canadian supply management program looks like. We would probably have something similar, but not the exact same thing. Canada has a quota system that even their farmers are saying is getting outdated. It should have been updated decades ago already. Because it's getting too pricey for farmers to continue buying into the program or even new farmers getting into that. We'd probably be looking at like a base program. So each active farm at the date of its inception would have a base. And, you know, you would have your 30 cow operators, you'd have your 3,000 cow operators. But we would work so that if there's an increase in consumer demand, which we've seen a 2 to 3% growth on a yearly basis for the last 30 years in this country. So looking at that 2% growth, that would be divided equally amongst the active producers. Or if we wanted to make sure there is an avenue for new farmers to get into the dairy industry, allow that 2 to 3% growth to come within the new producers that are there. One of the things that will always be a stress on that scenario is just the genetics that we have in animals and then the food that we feed them. We seem to be able to see those increases, to keep those increases that and meet that demand just within that itself. So looking at future plans, we'd certainly as an industry have to work together to make sure that we have possibilities for new producers, but also allow current producers to continue at their same levels that they're at.
Now, Joe, I mentioned that Farm Bureau Federation statement saying, you know, willing to consider a flexible supply management system, not rejecting it, not necessarily embracing it wholeheartedly. Where are you on the idea of supply management for dairy?
Well, let me go back a little bit. You know, this is something that has been debated by our delegates for as long as I have been involved, you know, with Farm Bureau. If I go back 25 years ago, the question was whether or not to support a quota type system. And I remember one of our farmers, Ron Tushner, getting up and speaking out against it wholeheartedly. That in America, everybody should have the right to succeed and everyone should have the right to fail. Last year was somewhat of a historic year. You know, first of all, it was 100 years for our organization, but the delegates did approve. We support research and development of a dairy growth management and other systems that provide increased dairy industry stability and producer profitability. And subsequently, the American Farm Bureau delegates approved. We support a flexible farmer and industry-driven milk management system, and we are opposed to a mandatory federal quota system. So there's a long history of these discussions. However, last year the delegates did approve the concept of research and development. And, you know, we're going to see here in about 10 days. I would never speak to my, you know, for my delegates. I am so proud of the Farm Bureau organization, the way they bring resolutions from the county level and bring them up to the state, that I really look forward to the debate again this year and see what direction our delegates give us. So I look forward to that.
Talking to the presidents of two Wisconsin farming groups, Joe Bragger with the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, Darren Von Ruden with the Wisconsin Farmers Union, both farmers themselves. And we're talking about the idea of some kind of dairy supply management system. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Cross Plains. Nate, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate you having these two gentlemen on. I come from a dairy family that been connected to dairying for 110 years. There unfortunately has been a continuous history, as the Farm Bureau representative said, of farm people not wanting to have any restrictions. But the consequence of that is now dairying in Wisconsin is entering into a phasing out of the industry. When you lose 7,000 or more dairy farmers at in a short period of time, going from when we had 30,000 farmers down to the much smaller number we have today, you're threatening not over the farming as a way of life and all the effects that that has on farm people, but also the economy of the state that ripples out of that. All of the small towns supporting industries, businesses, etc. So,
Nate, I'm going to jump in because we got two guests and not a ton of time, but a point taken. Darren, I know you're concerned, as Nate is, about the effect, if we lose those local dairy farmers, even if we're producing as much milk, about the impact it could have on a local rural community. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, certainly looking at how those dollars are distributed within those communities, when you have the small dairies and the family farm dairies that we've been accustomed to in the state, most of those dollars get spent locally. Now, when you see farms that are being owned by out-of-state ownership, or even, you know, family farms that have grown to, you know, 3,000-4,000 cows, have immigrant labor as their major source of labor, you know, how many of those dollars actually stay in that local community? We're seeing from the reports that we've got that a lot of those dollars don't actually stay there. That farmer's probably banking with a bank out of state. Their employee base sends those dollars back to their home countries to support their families there, and or they're just doing their grocery shopping in the Walmart that's two or three communities away sometimes. So how much of that money actually stays in the community from that growth with the size of the farms is really the big question.
Thanks for that call. And Joe, briefly before we take a quick break, your thoughts on that idea of if we're losing these smaller dairy farms, these local ones in some areas, and concentrating more, the hit that rural communities can take. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, certainly that there's a major concern for our rural communities. You know, dairy, we are the dairy state, and dairy certainly has been the prominent feature of many of our communities and the support that comes along with it when you think of the dollars that have turned over. So definitely, whether it's Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, or any other organization, we definitely are concerned about our members and are trying to get them to a place where they can be profitable and proud members supporting their communities.
Talking to Joe Bragger, a farmer in Buffalo County, president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, and Darren Von Ruden, dairy farmer from Westby, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Talk about the idea of dairy supply management and how it could impact Wisconsin dairy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a current dairy farmer? Are you out of the business? Or were you driven out by the economic conditions? What changes do you see needed? What do you think about this idea of some kind of supply management system? Call in now at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Wisconsin Farmers Union President Darren Von Ruden and Wisconsin Farm Bureau President Joe Bragger, both farmers themselves. We're looking at the idea of dairy supply management, what it could mean for farm operations here in the state. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Prescott. Dave, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I heard about the supply management system, and I think that's a baby step. I think that family-owned farms have been, well, since I was in my mid-20s in the 80s when there was Farm Aid, and I friends of mine were farmers, and their farms went out of business. And it was all because they couldn't make any money or sustain because the prices were so low, whether it was milk or other dairy products. And I think that it's time to put a cap on production, and I guess you would call that a quota system, similar to what Canada has. Their farmers are much healthier as an industry than ours are, and as the state of Wisconsin, you know, as someone said, 25% of the cheese in the nation comes from Wisconsin, and those two industries are tied. And I think that we have the clout that if we go to a quota system here, that'll affect the nationwide farm price.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. I want to ask each of you, start with you, Joe. You mentioned your members, to the extent they're open to the idea of supply management, they don't want it coming from, say, the federal government. Who would be, I guess, the decider when it comes to managing supply, at least from what you've heard from your members?
Well, and I have to be clear, you know, when you say open to the idea, you know, again, our language reads that we support research and development,
right.
and that's as far as that goes. You know, but also you have to look at the broader industry as a whole. You know, our federal milk marketing orders, we've got many members involved in those discussions. As of late, the producer price differentials have hit us. And so I can't say enough, you know, Darren, the work their group is doing, our farmers on the Farm Bureau side that are engaged in these discussions. Zippy Duval, the American Farm Bureau president, just recently put out a letter that farmers need to be at the table. And I think that is the beginning of any progress, is farmers coming together, discussing the issues, working through what, you know, different ideas and putting it out on the table and trying to make a change. You know, a farmer gets up every day. He loves his land. He loves the water, takes care of the animals with the ultimate goal of being a proud member to be able to support their community. And again, I'm just so proud that this discussion is going on.
And Darren, the Farmers Union, I know, more into the idea of supply management. Who would be the decider? Who would you see being in charge of setting the production maximums and things like that?
Well, it would be a joint effort of the whole industry. So, you know, looking at farmer representatives, processor representatives, certainly have to have some government involvement there, especially when you're looking at trade deals and how international trade happens. Canada has a system of, you know, getting together quarterly within that group that are appointed by their processors and the farmer members themselves. So it's going to have to be a joint effort because just the dairy farmers can't do it. Just the processors can't do it. And we certainly don't want the government to do it for us. You know, farmers are really asking for more of a voice in our futures than what we've been able to have over the last five, 6 decades.
Here's a question from Paul in Lincoln County. Paul says, do we have an unofficial cheap food policy in the country that's made us too used to low food prices and meant production has had to be so high? Let's throw that at you, Darren, throw that at you first. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, certainly looking at how, especially the subsidy world in agriculture has been lately, you know, it seems like we want to get the price of our food down to zero. There's absolutely nothing in this world that is absolutely free. So we have to figure out how to make sure that the part of the consumer dollar that the farmer receives is greater than what it currently is and what it has been for probably the last 2 to 3 decades. Looking back to the 1980s, dairy farmers received about 45% of the consumer dollar. Today, we're under 16% that dairy farmers are receiving. So where did that 30% of the consumer dollar go when you look at the profit margins of some of the larger processors in the country? We can certainly see where that's went. You know, and that's another reason why we need to get to a supply management mechanism that allows more discussion between the farmers and the processors so that we can continue to pull some of those dollars back to the farm level.
And Joe, what are your thoughts on that question from Paul about cheap food in the United States, maybe keeping up production too high?
Well, certainly, I think Darren touched on the percentages, and that's something I think of a lot of times. We operate on very slim margins, and when I started farming, those margins were 30% or greater, that, you know, for every dollar you moved off the farm, you kept that much on to take care of the farm, to do the upgrades, the maintenance, and the improvements that are needed to take place all the time. If we go to where we are now, those margins are well under 10%, and in the last few years, they've been negative. So certainly that has a great impact on that farm's ability to be profitable. But in all of this discussion, I think something that we can't leave out is the consumer and how, you know, how do we increase profitability on the farm? What programs are available? What systems and improvements need to be put in place while still protecting our consumer out there from severe price increases?
We'll leave it there for now. Joe, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron.
And Darren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
We've been talking to Darren Von Ruden, dairy farmer from Westby, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, and Joe Bragger, runs a farm in Buffalo County. He's the president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, two big farm groups here in Wisconsin. And we talked to them about the idea of dairy supply management in Wisconsin and around the nation. One solution being offered and promoted by the Farmers Union in particular to the problem of fluctuations in dairy prices, low dairy prices, driving a lot of Wisconsin dairy farmers out of the business. If that's you, if you have a story to share about being in dairy right now or being driven out of it over the last decade or two, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And let us know what's happened and what kind of changes you would like to see in the future. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll dig into the past, present, and future of the American middle class. The author of the book, The Riches of This Land, says there's a lot we can learn about creating a thriving American middle class from the era after World War II. And he says we need to overcome some basic myths along the way. 2020 marks 30 years since the Americans with Disabilities Act took effect. We'll hear from two writers in a new anthology about the lives of people with disabilities and the importance of having them be part of the political and cultural life of our country. A lot more people are getting into sewing in the pandemic year. We'll find out why so many are dusting off and firing up the machine and get some advice. Plus a talk with Wisconsin author Nicholas Butler with some reading recommendations. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra. It's a time-honored nickname that will stick around forever, no matter what. But one of Green Bay's biggest rivals has something even the Packers don't have on the frozen tundra. Actual penguins on the field. Earlier this month, Chicago's Soldier Field, home to NFL's Chicago Bears, and the Chicago Fire soccer team hosted another team built for cold weather conditions. There were four Magellanic penguins, and they were visiting from Soldier Field's neighbor, Shedd Aquarium. The famous, and let's face it, awesome aquarium has been closed because of COVID-19. The staff there has been finding ways to get their penguins some exercise in new and exciting places. In a video released by Shedd Aquarium, we meet the penguins Izzy, Darwin, Tombo, and Charlotte. They make their way from the home team locker room through the tunnel and triumphantly out onto the field. Or pitch, technically. It was set up for soccer at the time. The penguins frolic around and explore the field for a while. They're not the most intimidating front four you're ever going to see. They don't even seem to get the basics of sports. Their trainers left out a football and a soccer ball. And in the video, penguins run up toward them and then right past them. It's too bad. I hear the Bears could use a quarterback right about now. You can see the videos on the Shedd Aquarium Facebook and Twitter feeds. And I'm sorry, Bears fans, I've never been so excited to see the home team running onto Soldier Field. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.